Excellent. I want to thank Paul, Casey and Sean and everyone involved in the Ovale readings. It's a hell of a pleasure to be here. I must have worn my own blinkers here tonight because I didn't notice the horse's head. I'm sure there's a story to that, but it's great. Nice to be in the most quiet bar in Ireland. I've been charmed while I've been in Ireland, but more particularly Cork. I do live in Seoul where people are mindlessly aspirational, sleeplessly aspirational. I teach in a literature program and some of my students survive on 3 or 4 hours sleep a night. And so they don't seem to have the ability to be reflective or to connect effectively their experiences in the world. That seems to be the exact reverse in Ireland, where people are genuinely open-hearted, open-minded, able to be reflective, able to listen and able to connect and communicate. So I've been genuinely charmed during my time here. All that I said about Ireland seems to pertain more particularly to people in Cork. I don't know, did you call yourself Corkers? I've been calling myself
Corkonians.
Corkonians, my apologies. No self-intended. So, Corkonians, it's my real pleasure to be in your company tonight. I'll start reading. I'm going to read a couple of different styles of poem. I guess I fall broadly into my work falls broadly into poems about place and my connections to place, whimsical poems which sort of push the boundary of what a poem can or could be, and then poems that are sort of exploring prosodically and formally, again, in a sort of a responsive way, but responding to texts that I read. I spend a lot of time reading. So, look, I'll start with an Ars Poetica, which has an epigraph from Wallace Stevens. Reality is a cliché from which we escape by metaphor. The poem's called Toward a Unifying Theory of Non-Coincidence. Late into the night, we sat, practicing our similes like morgue attendants in a power strike, or an army of amnesiacs, a draft blue inside a painting of a grove of trees, and across, further out, a frozen lake. No one heard the pianos, though outside, a septet of trumpets blew hard toward tonight, while on TV a Philistine booted a ball to a big barbarian in shorts. The galaxy remained happy as an underbite. Elsewhere in the evening, in gravestone plots of ticking cities, the dead who tick not murmured, "We do not think, therefore we are not." While in films everywhere said a voice, "Dolce behind the mirror." It remained butterflies versus butterfly collectors. I remember once upon a time, also in a field big as the world, verdant, flat, I read an interesting and plotless book, four cloaked guys on muleback, the colour of a dusk newly begun, wrote out the vanishing point, while, yes, above, a blackbird diagonal in the Empyrean twittered on and on. How fragile the promise of apocalypse. How well wrought. How remote. As the worm in its beak, I thought, shook a clenched end at us all, yelling, "Metaphor is a cliché from which we escape by reality." While further up, the muffled noise of pianos. 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 Thank you. Okay, so I wrote a suite of poems about the 120-kilometre trip I used to travel on once every fortnight when my parents' marriage finished. So, and the road is really whole suite of very curving bends. So, three kids under 10 years of age, four kids, me and my three brothers, all feeling very car sick, listening to my father sing songs the whole way. Sort of etched itself into my memory. There's a different connection to land in Australia than to here, I think, because we white Australia is only 200 years old. Yeah. So the land's been instrumentalised in a kind of brutal way. Yeah. It's got a use value, and it's not cared for the way that land seems to be cared for in Ireland. People are sort of leading often lonely, desperate lives in these little outposts in the middle of absolutely nowhere. And these are the towns that we passed through on the way from Bairnsdale, where my mother moved with myself and three brothers, to Omeo, where my father lived. So this suite sort of tracks that journey backwards and forwards. It's called Small Town Etudes, Omeo Highway, Great Dividing Range. And if there's any words that I need to explain, I'll do so before the poem. The subtitles are the names of the towns. Okay. So, Bairnsdale. The sky is starling-filled granite, its open country veneered with estates, sudden as dark water rising. Main Street clusters with pensioners combing back their hair in cafeterias and blinking over cappuccino, the daily paper, alone. At the rotunda, auctioneers admire bank windows reflective as cattle trucks rattling empty toward mountains. Cicada husks cling to fence lines in prefab paddocks. Mares buck the abattoir scent curling at town's edge, where hammerfall and lowing flattens into the null. Rhythm. Like caravans at a crossroads, the cows stand, monolithic in this quasi-primal scenery, chewing at the floodplain trees, crooked beside roadhouses, lean back from the horizon. Insight. The town clenched around its highway and roadkill, cars tilting through the disequilibrium, unstopping. The CWA knits and chainsaws grind at scrub lines like incisors. Somewhere, as trees fall, the ministrations of Radio National. In the dimly lit kitchens of farmer widows, weekly appellations of panic. The fire brigades practice an occult minuet in these dry-mouthed hills, where rabbits stump the blind underground and eels slide up pussy willow riverbeds. In this garden of delights, it's the unquiet that is landmark, unspoken, encircling as the sentences of strange ghosts. Swift's Creek. The creek bends over stone, a snake unskinning itself. Hats gather at the servo and trucks slough past, unloading clear fell at the mill. A bus draws into school, freckled generations at its windows. Up the road, the cemetery is carved with phone book names. Omeo. These mountains locked as a grave. Sheep stare through seasons. Work dogs howl on chains and fill ring-barked afternoons. Weather speculations drawl out the windows of four-wheel drives in town for groceries. Locals thumb their belt loops. A crow scours the hills. Lawnmowers are droning. Orchestrations of dominion. The last poem's for Nambra. Two things. My father, when he was working as an electrician, and he drove the local school bus around some of these towns. And he tells the story of a gentleman in a Mercedes-Benz arriving in Bunambra, the last town in the suite. And the Mercedes-Benz of Banbury is a rare machine indeed. And the guy winds down his window and says, "Excuse me, can you tell me where this road goes once I drive through the township?" And my father answered very quickly, "It doesn't go anywhere, mate, you fall off." It's that kind of place. Second thing is that Kosciuszko is Australia's tallest mountain, Banambra. The sky almost a void. Kosciuszko, it's distant steeple. In the cleared valleys, boxwood stumps gnarl amid haystacks inert as tractors rusting on blocks. The weatherboards here, scant and haunted in the bawling frames of wind, scatter out darker altitudes, where hair trigger farmers, stark with short answers, lope across taut daylight. Quince and crabapple rot in dropped circles, while scarecrow, mute as doppelganger, survey the wild churchyard, long empty of its song. Thank you. So to keep going with poems about place, I thought I'd read you a soul poem. So Seamus Heaney says that poetry is language knocked sideways, and one of the great joys for me is travelling, where I sort of feel that every footstep is potentially a new poem, a sublime moment. So, you know, as if I'm sort of retuning my mind to someone else's version of reality. And that's certainly the case in Seoul, where it's a Confucian society, so very, very strictly hierarchical. There's someone in Seoul who's at the top of all those hierarchies. I've never met him or her, but a powerful person. This one's called One Size Fits All. Behaviours tend to be people are less in control of their own way of being in this particular culture. So people my students, for example, are forever being told what to do by a grandparent. Go and study English literature so they can get a job in a multinational company and make the family rich. You know? So there's sort of a duty-bound way of being in the world there that I find astonishing. So anyway, One Size Fits All, that's from Seoul. And the epigraphs are from Korean texts that I've read. The first from Cho Seung-ja slow motion video. A man is dying on the dark screen of an obscure lifetime. And the lips are bidding a metallic hello to bouquets of fresh humans. Sinchon Metro, downstairs, and all the ghosts are milling, slumped amid the drab corners of an undercity. What is it? In the earphoned heads, the handheld screens, the pulses force unthinkingly below the grey, glass, choreography of machines under a floor plan of dirty cloud. One of the great things about Korea, I don't want to be entirely negative about the place, is that they're tremendous poetry readers. One of my mates who's in his 30s, his first book sold, I think, 40,000 copies, which is a dream for a poet. I've another friend who's a sort of mid to late career poet, and she's retired because her third book sold more than 1 million copies. So the trick for us all is to learn Korean very quickly and then knock out of the collection. The thing that Koreans do very well thematically is love connected to sorrow. So that's what we have to do. We have to write sorrowful love poems in Korean, then we can retire as poets. The other thing that I'll say is that every Korean, from that tall up to the elderly, know this particular poem, Azaleas. It's like their national poem, and it is a sorrowful love poem. They can all recite it, and it's pretty much just the story of a resentful lover pretending not to care at all as their now ex-lover walks out on them. And the epigraph is, "Azaleas, by the armful I'll scatter in your path." So I thought I'd write a sort of a sorrowful love poem to Pyongyang in North Korea. I'm in Seoul. I keep on getting asked in island. So do you work in North or South Korea? But no one that I'm aware of works in North Korea. So very much South Korea. But North Korea is only 193 kilometers away. Pyongyang is only 193 kilometers away from Seoul. So it's not quite within spitting distance, but it's extremely close. Anyway, so here's my sorrowful love poem to Pyongyang. On the flatlands of the northern city, an industry of empty daydream thuds up uniformed avenues. On the outpost hills, azaleas in their uniforms keep pressing into the shine. And Ajumma is a married lady in Korean. So Ajoshi for a married man, Ajumma for a married lady. Kim Gente, I'm a bundle of hope. The epigraph is Ajumma, how much for one bundle of hope? The moon goddesses of Nandamun Market bent backed as autumn persimmon trees, these sisters out the way, sweeping the leaves of ginkgo from an heirloom of afternoons, a forest of skyscraping gritting the traffic loft, where paddy field armies of once brothers loll in neon mist. One of the things that happens at uni that I can't stand is the photocopy guy stands in his tiny little room and leaves the photocopier up. So you get this sudden burst of light flashing at you. And I don't know how he lives. I worry about this guy. It's kind of for me, at least, it's the same as having fingernails down a chalkboard, right? It's sort of just that bang. I worry about this guy. So photocopier room, so again, university. Smudged by toner dust and staring daylong into the machine's open head full of light, punched like a shadow in his box of luminescence, another shift, tick, tick, ticks, an examination of uncontested claims from the wiseness of clocks. This photocopier, stone-eyed, a facsimile of origins, too bright, lost. And the last one. After Kim Yong text, we must enter the bright world you opened for us. Bridge, sunset, workers. The Han River, a brown centipede across dusk, dodging turnip growers, growling at clogged footways. Stacked plumes huff into the haze. City of hungry ghosts, the future is imminent. Skies uncracked by a bullet or bird. It isn't martyrs, but plastic flowers that pucker the concrete now, upright in forgotten gloom. Some of the more whimsical poems. Ilogos. It all began with me trying to open a small wooden box from the inside. This was a quiet place and windless too, though I left it nonetheless, kicking my way through into a slightly larger wooden box. Here, things were filled with a quietness and not much wind. I kicked in the wooden wall of this box and clambered into yet another quiet and windless box, where I thrashed the wall and took a run up before breaking into a slightly larger still wooden box. How charmingly windless and quiet it is here, I noted, as I kicked down the wooden wall to discover a slightly larger wooden box. Inside, it was windless and quiet, as was the next wooden box, the next, and every other box I discovered the rest of that month. Which is very much how I feel at work. Okay. So. Ecce Homo is the little sign above Christ when he gets crucified. This poem's called Ecce Hombres, which is, instead of Ecce Homo means behold the man, Ecce Hombres, behold the dude. behold the dew. A thing eats a thing and is eaten by another thing. This thing not lasting long is eaten by a further thing, the further thing eaten by something again, eaten soon after by something else. This thing is trapped and eaten by another thing, which is then eaten by a thing. And so goes. This thing, kidnapped and fattened with small things by a biggish thing, is eaten. The biggish thing, fattening thing, ambushed, carried twixt the pole to a rocky place with no garden, is put in a stewing pot and eaten by a thing which is eaten by another thing, eaten soon after by something else. This thing is eaten by another thing called Craig. Craig, though perhaps never believing in the unstoppable nature of destiny, is also eaten. The eater of Craig has no name. Bored from the outset, a thing eats a thing with no name that ate the thing that ate Craig and is tackled sometime later by two other things who pick at bones in the dark below the howl at moon. Later, a town of things eats a town of other things, right down to the huts and the family portraits. Soon after, a colony of bedraggled and limping stray things eats them as they return home, but you'd expect behaviour like that from things like those. And so, it goes. A thing with a paunch and silver monocle conducts a cogged factory where things package other things for resale and polystyrene with barbecue sauce. Fat kahuna things loll and burp in the gentle night in their lockdown rooms in the sky, above the canker of gutter things being eaten by gutter things. Dawn things eat night things, chewing dust things on day things, swallowed by the footstepping time thing, devoured in turn by the thing that has no words thing. Wind things eat windless things, thin things bite and gnaw at nothing things, mad screaming things suck the marrow of whisper things, and the star things eat the bits of the heavens thing. A thing eating a thing becomes eaten by another thing, but somewhere a horse made of bullion sinks to the bottom of a soundless sea and is declared a permanent mystery, not to mention inedible. And so it goes. Okay, The Heroic is Sublime Sum, after a painting by Barnett Newman in seven sections. One. In deep sleep wards, bedside voices assign their love of beauty a metaphysical homesickness. We, like moths on a pleasure flight through a bonsai forest, can hear almost nothing. Two. Inside the Institute of Melancholia, test tubes spiral like the glassy echoes of unheard children. Bright rooms filling with unopened folders mark whatsoever you think is illusion. The world stays calm as a memory, breathed across a mirror. Three. We packed our suitcases with dirt, held our prayers, stamped at the edges of metamorphosis. Behind us, the broken city's burlesques. In front, the heavy institute gates and ether. At this height, full of gravitas. Four. On the plains of this idea and just beyond sight, a queue, infinitely long and not speaking, an indefinite and bloodless transplantation. Five. Only such grievous ones as we could have such godless, unspeaking gods. Six. The clocks on the walls here have never once moved. Seven. Thank you. I I was down at Skibbereen the last week or so, a place that I truly fell in love with, and I was there for the Arts Festival, and saw some amazing people, including Mick Flannery, who I believe is from here, and loved what he does very much. I was speaking to one poet, Seamus Hogan, who read a poem that took 30 years to get published. And I love that, but you know, poets are great collectors, usually of their own work. And sometimes that work forms into a context that we don't see when we write the poem. So you know, 3 decades later, the poem materialised publicly. So and I think we can all relate to that, getting our best work returned to us unpublished. When that happened to me, I wrote a poem about it, and it's called How to Hunt March Hare. Take a gun unloaded to the hole one moonless night. Call your closest taxidermist friends and tell them to stay at home. Take a portable fence on which to sit. If making noise, do so politely. Wait. Recheck your artillery. Keep waiting. Kill time with a croquet mallet and some beers. Check the direction of the wind and your eyeballs. Wheel in a light orchestra. Grow a beard. Kick down the portable fence. Maintain focus. Take some speed. Take some mescaline. Quote Machiavelli through a loudspeaker from the back of a military green shrub. Shake your fists at a god and the stars. Do not fool around with atom splitting. Build a fake hole. Climb in and imitate snoring loudly. Know your quarry well. Help the infirm or write pornography for money. Focus, no time for waiting now. Forget your childhood nightmares and fling a rope into the hole. Stand there with a searchlight, hum the outro to MASH. Enunciate loudly, come up with your hands out and have the orchestra undertake an overture. Listen for the rustling of abstraction beneath you. Ran as though there were a moon tonight. Load the gun with a paper sheet. Wait. Pull out a cigarette. Keep waiting. Grab more beer. Looks like everyone here is in for the long haul. Mm. I've seen so many poets stay too long at the microphone that I'm very wary of doing so, and prefer to read less than too much. But so let me know if I'm bending your ears for too long, won't you? So yeah, one of the things that I'm doing here at the moment is writing villanelles, five tercets and a quatrain, with the first and the third lines of the first. First tercet repeated throughout the body of the text, and I'm bending that to my own purposes. I'm excavating the form and writing a kind of a free verse villanelle, if there is such a thing, if that doesn't seem too paradoxical. They respond to a range of different sources, and I'm reading with a poet's brain rather than an analytical mind. And by that I'm sensitised to the language rather than the content or the meaning contained in the language. So these are sort of pretty experimental texts, and I love doing them. I'll read a couple to you. So we all know who John Cage is, experimental composer. He wrote that beautiful 4 minutes 22 where he approaches the piano, sits down, takes the tails of his tuxedo out from underneath him, flexes the fingers, and then closes the lid of the piano. For 4 minutes 22, we listen to the occasional noise surrounding the performance of this masterpiece. I kind of love his ideas. He's a sort of a purist who was always chasing silence. Impossibly. He went into a chamber in, I think, Harvard, where they need soundlessness as much as possible. And it's underground, and it's encased in successive layers of concrete. And he wanted to find silence there. And he heard two noises, one high-pitched and one low-pitched. And the high-pitched noise was the sound of his own nervous system, and the low-pitched noise was the coursing of his blood. So silence, we're embodied. We can't achieve silence. It's an abstract idea. So I kind of love the concept that pushed him through his career, this eternal search for something that was impossible to locate, a sort of a heroic quest. So I use a lot of John Cage in these villanelles. This text responds to his essay Lecture on Something, pushed against his other essay Lecture on Nothing. There is a smaller myself inside desire, calling, watch the sleep of birds, formal as a sculptor's encounter with disorder. I'm here, and this is a glass of milk, anyone's own home, discussions ramble the hours, masterpieces of animal continuity, those rare phonologies of desire, where a smaller myself is calling, profound objects require thorough handling, and the interactions of flesh plus ecstasy fly us to the brilliant nowheres of eye, and here, and this is a glass of milk, musical as sunlight, black telephones ringing through fields, lonely as a minotaur's social calendar. Inside desire, there's a smaller myself calling, regard the stream of neighbouring principles manufacturing beauty, where sentimental techniques of climax recapitulate heroically. I'm here, and this is a glass of milk built structurally into the shifting architecture of breakfast's frame, autobiographically naked, and inside desire, there is a smaller myself calling, I'm here, and this is my glass of milk. So the Paris Review, the journal, has a great interview series, The Art of Fiction and then The Art of Poetry. And The Art of Poetry is just a repository of canonised voices, sort of disclosing their secrets of production and the engines behind the impulse to be a poet. So really a great repository or archive of ideas about what poems are, why poems are, and the people who build them. What they were doing. So I spent a lot of time reading those to get to these journals as well. This one responds to the interview in the Paris Review with Ted Hughes. I spent the first years of my life in a valley, sitting in woods muffling the occult business of little folk tales. Madness sometimes works amid the machines, kept running elegiacally by large sets of hands, sweeping populations of crow from each momentary wholeness. I spent the first years of my life in a valley, enchanted by the noise of complex human emotion. It was big trouble in tweed jackets, the very wide landscapes of modern man. And this is why madness sometimes works, a tradition with its own gods and holograms. In a wilderness of anthropological models inside the encyclopedias of children, I spent the first years of my life in a valley, conscious as animals inside hotel room dreams, with TV screens jamming on runaway walls crackling away. Maybe this is why madness sometimes works, like a flash of ancient film, telepath from an unseen watching mind. There's an infinite number of possibilities if you concentrate like a good bird. So, I spent the first years of my life in a valley where madness sometimes works. Okay. Okay. Same interview series. This one, no response to the language that T.S. Eliot was using when he was responding to the questions. I think it's awfully dangerous to give general advice to those dying of drink or shipwreck or suicide. One thing or another, once you know how to observe them, it's wise not to try to form people in your own image. Fancy old-fashioned boom-boom, cloak and dagger, Georgian scenes. I think it's awfully dangerous to give general advice. As one gets older, one cannot distinguish genius among new, younger men. Purchase woolen underwear because of the damp stone. Once you know how to observe them, it's wise to visit the dead in their triangular sitting rooms. Wives typing forgotten names that no longer exist. I think it's awfully dangerous to give general advice to revolutionaries weeping over a cat that's gone wrong. A force without its limitations. Once you know how to observe them, it's wise to violate the laughing sources. Common as speech, essential and permanent, and gloomy indeed. I think it's awfully dangerous to give general advice. Once you know how to observe them, it's wise to violate rules. Yeah, one, yeah, great, good. I might read one last poem, a short one. No, I'll just read one. So I started with an Ars Poetica, a poem about poetry. I'll end with a poem about poets, very short one. And it's called Poets. As if there's graveyard dirt on our souls, as if we live in houses with covered mirrors, as if each mid-morning there's no right side to climb from our beds. So many muttering about silence, spruiking the Godhead, nondescript as our job descriptions and making memos to the immemorial. So many thinking on time, on love and where that goes, on nothing. Someday hearts may shudder as we stoop, moan and blink. Blown audience of stars arriving early. Thanks, everyone. Thank you.